Okay, let's hope for the best. Now, I'm Dr. Deborah Moshowitz, and I'll be lecturing for the rest of the term. Those are my office hours this week. I won't be in Thursday. Normally I am, and there are additional office hours on Thursday afternoon from 4 to 5. Almost all the announcements that I think are important are either on the notes or in the announcements on the webpage. There will be no PowerPoints posted because I'm not going to use PowerPoint. There will be handouts every day in class with the diagrams that I intend to cover, and my intent is that you will take those and scribble on them and deface them. And if you want clean ones to study from, just take two. There are plenty. The notes will be posted the night before, probably by 7 or 9 o'clock, because I like to do it before I go home. I think that's basically it. If you have any questions about administrative matters, don't hesitate to ask me either after class or during my office hours. Now, Dr. Chazen pointed out that in this section of the class, I think it's still too much hum. That in this section of the class, is it still loud enough? Yeah. We're going to talk about nucleic acids. And the first thing I want to do is explain, although he gave a brief introduction, why we're going to get up to our ears in nucleic acids. Now, what is the main issue in this class? You could say that the main issue this semester is how does one E. coli make two? So in order to do that, the cell has to double all of its constituents. And Dr. Chazen discussed how a cell gets the energy to do that and how it makes things like small molecules, polysaccharides, complex lipids. But we know by now that the key to all of it is making the right proteins. And the question then is, how does the cell know, quote unquote, which proteins to make? What determines what proteins are made? Now, we know that for a protein, if you determine the amino acid sequence, that is the primary structure, the rest will take care of itself. So the important question is, what determines the primary structure of proteins? Now, as Dr. Chazen mentioned briefly last time, it's very unlikely to be a protein. Now, enzymes do everything else. Why don't they make proteins? Well, if you have an enzyme to add on each amino acid, who made that enzyme? And so you get yourself into an infinite regression problem that you would need too many proteins. So what one comes down to is the conclusion that there must be something which is not protein that lines up the amino acids in the correct order. And once the amino acids are lined up in the correct order, then one or a small number of proteins can come along and make the peptide bonds, and we have our protein. But what is it that serves as the so-called template or gets the amino acids lined up? So, what's the template? Now, there is, of course, the question of what is it made out of. But what does it have to do? We just said that it has to determine amino acid sequence. So we call that job one. But it's not enough for the template to do that. Because we know that not only does a cell make each cell or each organism make a particular collection of proteins, but their descendants make the same collection of proteins. So these instructions, whatever they're made out of, have to be passed on from generation to generation. When one E. coli makes two, you have to have two copies of this template so that each daughter cell will get one and will be able to make the same proteins. So this template actually has to have two jobs. It not only directs protein synthesis, it has to somehow direct copying of itself. Now, what we've got so far is what you might call the biochemical view of the situation. After biochemists figured out that it is proteins and enzymes that control everything else, they came around to the conclusion that there must be a template which determined protein sequence and somehow could be copied and passed on. And they were interested in what is it made of and how does it do its two jobs. Now, biochemists by themselves could not figure that out. At the same time, geneticists had arrived at a similar idea. We all know that offspring resemble their parents. From analyzing crosses between variants, geneticists had come to the conclusion that there was something called the genetic material. And that this determined the traits of the organism. Since frogs have frogs and people have people, except in fairy tales, this must be passed on from generation to generation. Frog information passed on to frog, human information passed on to humans. So this somehow must be copied and passed on. Now, it seems pretty obvious that these two are talking about the same thing. The geneticists by themselves could not determine what the genetic material was made of or how it did this. But now if you put it together, it becomes clear that the template and the genetic material must be the same thing. And so a piece of the genetic material, which we call a gene, must somehow determine or be read out to determine a structure of a particular protein. And then that protein must do some job. And most of the time, in all the cases we've talked about, that means it catalyzes a reaction. Now, proteins do other things as well, but we haven't talked about them very much. But whatever the job is, the protein does it. And depending on how well this reaction goes, how well the protein performs its job, that determines the trait. So this puts together the biochemical view and the genetic view of the situation. Now, as we explained, neither biochemists nor geneticists by themselves could figure out what the gene was made of or how it did its two jobs, how it got copied and how it caused the production of protein. And what we're going to talk about for the next part of this class is what the gene is made of and how it does that. Now, I'm sure if I asked you, you would all tell me what the gene is made out of. I can't imagine there's anyone in this room who does not know. What is it made out of? It's made out of DNA. This has become such common knowledge that there are ads in the subway station that say things like, we are a respectable company, it's in our DNA. So, it's become a euphemism for essence. So, everybody knows the answer, that this is made of DNA. But what we want to ask is, how did scientists figure that out? It turns out it needed a combination of biochemical approaches and genetic approaches to do it. And it's that combination that is usually called molecular biology. The use of these two approaches together, biochemical and genetic, and trying to figure out what is the genetic material made out of and how does it work. Now, you've heard a lot about biochemistry. So you all know that you could break a cell open and you could separate the various parts if you wanted to. But how would you know which part was the genetic material? Suppose you took a cell and you broke it open. You would be able to make what's called an extract, which is simply a solution of all the parts of the cell that dissolve in water. So this is the water-soluble parts. And then you could separate those, say, into DNA, RNA, protein, and let's say polysaccharide. Not to mention the small molecules, but these are all the big ones. Which of those is the genetic material? Well, you all know what the answer is. But how are you going to know which of these is the genetic material? You need a test or an assay system for the genetic material. And that assay system comes from genetics. One of the things that geneticists do is they obtain variants, and then they cross the variants to see what happens. So there were two strains of the bacterium that causes pneumonia, that is pneumococcus, which are called type 1. We'll just call them in type 2. These are both variants of the bacterium that causes pneumonia. And each variant is inherited. This type gives rise to more type 1s. Type 2 gives rise to more type 2s. And the difference between these is they differ in their ability to make a polysaccharide. So we'll call them PS plus and PS minus. This terminology usually means able to do it plus, not able to do it. So PS plus is able to synthesize polysaccharide and PS minus cannot. Now, as a result of having this polysaccharide, it forms a coat around the bacteria, and so if you look at colonies of the bacteria, they have a capsule. But the PS minus bacteria don't. And as a result of this, when you look at colonies on a petri dish, type 1 bacteria, PS plus, make smooth colonies, but type 2 make rough. The point being that these two are very easy to tell apart. In addition to this difference, though, there is a functional difference, not just their appearance on petri dishes. That type 1, which is probably the normal or the wild type or the common one, type 1 is virulent, meaning that it causes disease. If these bacteria get into a mouse, they will multiply, cause severe pneumonia, and kill the mouse. So virulent, yes, meaning that it can kill a mouse. Probably could kill a human too, but no one's going to do an experiment to prove it. Now, type 2, on the other hand, are not virulent. Because of this lack of a capsule, the bacteria cannot reproduce inside a mouse. So they get into the mouse, but they don't do any harm. They don't reproduce, they don't cause pneumonia, and they don't kill the mouse. Now, before we go any further, how does this business correspond to all the biochemical pathway business that we have been talking about so far in this class? Have to get him to reweight this. Sometimes that does it. So, the idea is, in a PS plus bacterium, there's some precursor molecule that can be converted to polysaccharide. Oh, well. And that requires, of course, an enzyme. In a PS minus, there's something wrong with the enzyme. It isn't there or it doesn't work. So the precursor is not converted to polysaccharide because there's no working enzyme. But what is the job of genetic material? It's to determine what proteins are made. So presumably there's a piece of genetic material, which in this context we'll call a gene. A gene can mean several different things, but what it usually means is a section of the genetic material that codes for a particular protein. So there's a particular gene which is read out to make the appropriate enzyme. The enzyme catalyzes the reaction and you get polysaccharide. But in our PS minus, there's something wrong with the gene. The gene is defective or missing, so you don't get any enzyme. So, and so you can't catalyze the reaction. So PS plus and PS minus differ in whether they do or do not have polysaccharide, but that's a reflection of having a difference in their gene for the respective enzyme. Now, Griffith, I think, is the one who discovered by accident that you can convert PS minus into PS plus. And he found out this way. If you have PS minus bacteria and you infect a mouse, what happens to the mouse?
Nothing.
Live mouse. If you have dead PS plus bacteria and you put them into a mouse, what happens? What do you think dead bacteria do?
Nothing.
Correct. Now, for reasons I don't know, and I'm not sure if anyone remembers, somebody took the two together and infected a mouse. To the great surprise of one and all, the mouse died. And when bacteria were recovered from the mouse, there were live bacteria growing in the mouse, causing pneumonia that had done the mouse in, and those bacteria were PS plus. Now, what is going on here? The only reasonable conclusion is that something from the dead PS plus converted the live PS minus to PS plus. Something from the PS plus changed this gene so it became effective, made enzyme, and made polysaccharide. So that genetic material must have somehow been transferred from the PS plus to the PS minus. Now, this is not an efficient procedure. It turns out we know that only a very small number of PS minus cells get converted or transformed. How come we can detect a very rare event? If you have a few PS plus in here, that is, in the mouse, what happens to the mouse? The mouse eventually dies because only a few bacteria are needed to multiply many times and kill the mouse. So if only a few PS minus are transformed or converted, it's goodbye mouse. Now, what Griffith, I believe, or maybe it was Avery, discovered next was you don't have to use whole dead PS plus and live PS minus. Instead, you can use an extract. If you use, instead of whole dead bacteria, an extract of the same bacteria, meaning a water-soluble solution of macromolecules, that works too. So one of the molecules from the PS plus is capable of converting PS minus to PS plus. And now we have a test or an assay system for which molecule is the genetic material. Because we start with a PS plus cell, we make an extract, and we divide it into DNA, RNA, protein, and polysaccharide, using all those biochemical methods that you've learned about from Dr. Chazen. So if you have a test tube full of DNA, one of RNA, one of protein, one of polysaccharide. And now you add each of these to PS minus bacteria and infect a mouse. And the question is, does the mouse live or die? Well, before we answer this, there really are only two good candidates for the genetic material. And they are protein and DNA. And that's because chromosomes, which clearly carry genetic information, are made of protein and DNA. Well, by the argument that I used at the beginning of class and Dr. Chazen did last time, protein seems to be ruled out as the genetic material. But people still believed it had to be the genetic material anyway. That's because they didn't know much about the structure of DNA. It didn't seem to them that DNA could do these jobs. Also, up until that time, proteins did everything. Everything of interest in a cell was catalyzed by or directed by a protein. So if proteins do everything else, maybe they do this too. We don't understand how, but maybe they do. So when this experiment was done, people started with the preconception that it was going to be the protein which is going to be the active transforming principle. The protein was going to be able to transform, but that's not the result. None of these are active. None of these are capable of transforming a PS minus to PS plus. Only the DNA is able to transform. DNA from a PS plus converts a PS minus into PS plus. So what must be happening is a piece of DNA from here is getting into the PS minus, adding on to or replacing the equivalent gene, and allowing now the PS minus to make polysaccharide. Now, how do we know we've actually transferred the genetic material itself and not just the enzyme or something like that? The property of PS plusness is inherited. When you transform from PS minus to PS plus, the plus one now has plus descendants for multiple generations thereafter. So you have to have changed the instructions that are passed on from generation to generation. So the point of this experiment was to discover that it was DNA that was the active transforming principle, and therefore probably DNA that was the genetic material. Now, what are the consequences of implications of this finding? The first one is, people looked at this result and said, oh, well, if DNA is the genetic information or the genetic material, how does it do its two jobs? How did we figure out how protein works? We looked at the structure of protein, and from the structure of protein, we were able to see how it does its job. In the same way, people went and took a much closer look at the structure of DNA and figured out, indeed, how DNA could do this. And that's what we're actually going to do next. We're going to go and take a close look at the structure of DNA and see how it does its two jobs. But there's another follow-up to this experiment. What's happened in this experiment is the DNA from one organism was added to another and changed the properties of the recipient. You could say this is the first genetic engineering experiment. All current genetic engineering, recombinant DNA technology, etc., flows from this experiment. Now, we know that there are very few cases where a cell picks up DNA from the outside and uses it. That is, in nature. In nature, usually when a cell takes up DNA, it breaks it down into pieces and reuses the pieces. Why doesn't it just take the DNA? Did your mother ever say to you, if you eat another hamburger, you'll turn into a cow? Or something to that effect? It's usually if you eat another chocolate bar, you'll turn into a cocoa bean, but something like that. If you eat the DNA from an organism, then you would follow its instructions, and you would turn into whatever it was. So you don't, when you eat DNA or protein, you break it down into its monomers and reuse them. And there are very few exceptions to this. This happens to be one of the rare exceptions. But we now know that although it doesn't happen normally in nature, we can use lab techniques to get DNA from just about anywhere into just about anything. So we can take it from one organism or make it in a laboratory and put it into another organism and have it work. And this is the basis of genetic engineering, etc. And we will talk about that later in the term. Now, the other thing worth mentioning about this experiment is also that it's sort of the first molecular biology experiment. It's an example of where you can get, if you can combine biochemical technology of fractionation, etc., with genetic technology of having variants that you can compare. Without the genetic variants, we couldn't have done this. And you will see many other experiments as we go that combine these two. And that combination, as we said earlier, is what is meant by molecular biology, using the two technologies together to answer questions of interest to both fields. So now what we want to do is we want to go and take a really close look at the structure of DNA. We assume that, as with proteins, structure is going to be closely related to function. And so from the structure, we'll learn about function. So in order to do this, you need the handout from today, the stapled handout. Now, the point of these handouts is to save you from having to copy these formulas. So I expect you to take this out and to take notes on it. They're more in the back, they're more in the front. Some of the handouts that I hand out are on the web, some are not. I think that the paper versions are usually clearer than the scanned versions, but whichever one you want. If you need extra copies, there are always extra copies outside my office on the 7th floor of MUD. All right. So it says here, structure of nucleotides. What's with nucleotides? If you hydrolyze a protein, you break it down into its monomers, you get amino acids. If you hydrolyze a nucleic acid, either DNA or RNA, you get nucleotides. So a nucleotide is to DNA and RNA what an amino acid is to protein. So we want to look first at nucleotides. What is their structure and how are they hooked up to make a chain? Nucleotides of RNA and DNA are very similar, so they're laid out here in parallel. We'll talk about some of the differences, but we're going to concentrate this time on DNA. Now, nucleotides are a little more complicated than amino acids because they, in turn, have three parts. And those are listed here. The three parts are a sugar, a base, and a phosphate. Now, the structure at the bottom of your page one shows a complete nucleotide. And you can see that a nucleotide consists of a sugar in the middle, a base on one end, and a phosphate on the other. And I want to look at each of these pieces and then how they're connected. So let's start with the sugar. The sugar is ribose or a derivative of it, which is written here in the Haworth configuration. Now, this is a pentose, a 5-carbon sugar. What I have just written is the sugar found in DNA, which is deoxyribose, because there is no oxygen here, only an H. Plain old ribose, which is shown on your left and is found in RNA, plain old ribose is almost exactly the same, except it has an OH here. So the difference is whether you have an H attached to this carbon or an OH. Now, that turns out to make both a practical difference, as we will explain. But otherwise, the two of them, ribose and deoxyribose, are virtually the same. Now, you notice these little numbers here with the primes. We want to number the carbons in this sugar so we can keep track of what's going on. So you would think this is the number one, or the anomeric carbon. It's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. This is a 5-carbon sugar. However, we're also going to number the atoms in the base. And to keep straight, when you say C4, whether you mean the one in the base or the one in the sugar, the positions in the sugar are called prime. So the 5-prime position always refers to the sugar, and the 5 position always refers to the base. Now, this is an anomeric carbon, the one that was a C double bond O in the straight chain configuration. So as you all know by now, this OH could be down or it could be up, and it's still the same sugar. The difference is whether it's the alpha version or the beta version. The one you're looking at is the alpha version with the OH down in this representation. But you notice when it's hooked to a base, the hook is always in the beta configuration, that is up. That's just the way it is. Now, here is your sugar. As our little picture on the bottom indicates, our sugar is the middleman. It is linked to the base on one end and the phosphate on the other. The base is linked to the one prime carbon, and the phosphate is always, virtually always linked to the five prime position. In both cases, the connection is made by removing water. So you remove water, or you have a dehydration, you take an OH from one constituent and an H from the other, you make water, and you're left with a bond. So to the base, there's a bond here to the 1 prime, and the phosphate is on the 5 prime. All right, I think for the moment, that's all we want to say about sugars. But now, what about the bases? The bases are called bases because they all pick up protons. They all have basic properties. But from our point of view of their job in DNA or RNA, it is not their basic properties which are of interest. What is of interest to us is the groups on the ring that are capable of forming hydrogen bonds. Now, one of the bases, for example, is C, which is drawn over here on the far left top. Its full name is cytosine. The names are written down on the bottom in the boxes. The bases are usually referred to by the first letter of their name. So people say C instead of cytosine. And here you see are the positions. And you see this is labeled as well. Now, what's important here is what groups can form hydrogen bonds. This position here, the 3, will actually be linked to the base. It's the removal of this hydrogen and an OH from the sugar, which allows us to make the covalent bond between the sugar and the base. But once the base is linked up through its 3 position, the double bond O is sticking out. There's an N here, and there's the H's from the NH2. And all those groups are capable of forming hydrogen bonds. Some of them will be the delta negative end, some of them will be the delta positive end. But these are all available. And what's important is that C, U, A, and G have different groups sticking out from the ring or in the ring, and are therefore capable of making a different combination of hydrogen bonds. We'll come back to the details later. Now you notice there are 2 basic classes of bases. There are single ring bases called pyrimidines and double ring bases called purines, labeled on your handout. This is a single ring base or a pyrimidine. The way I always remember which is that the purines, which are bigger, have a shorter name. So the 2 purines are the same, whether we're talking about DNA or RNA. They are adenine and guanine. Now, of the pyrimidines, one is the same, whether you're talking DNA or RNA, that's C. But of the 4 bases, there is one that is different between DNA and RNA, and that is uracil or U versus T. Now, if you look at them, you will notice that they are almost the same. Both of them have a double bond O here at the 6th position, an NH, and a double bond O. And they're connected to the sugar here. So both of them have the same group sticking out, capable of making hydrogen bonds. But what's different is in T, there's a methyl group here, and in U, there's a hydrogen. Now you can see now that DNA is different from RNA in 2 respects. That DNA has deoxyribose, RNA has ribose. DNA has T or thymine, and RNA has U. Now, it seems reasonable to us that there are differences, because DNA and RNA serve different functions. DNA is the master copy, and as we'll see, RNA is the working copy. So the cell has to be able to distinguish them, because one has to be preserved, and one is degraded after it's used and thrown away. And you have to know which is the original and which is the copy, so to speak. It turns out, however, that these differences don't appear to be random. Cells don't work as well if the T is in the RNA and the U is in the DNA, or if the ribose deoxyribose is reversed. We will come back to these differences later, but the short answer is that having deoxyribose makes DNA less reactive and more stable. And having T instead of U makes DNA more repairable relative to RNA. And this is something we will get back to much later, if at all. But the books explain all why this is, if you're curious. Okay, so the only thing else we should probably say about the bases is that position 3 in the one-ring pyrimidines is what's connected to the sugar, but it's position 9 in the purines, which is connected to the sugar. And that's labeled on A, which one that is. But in both cases, in all cases, the way you make a bond between the base and the sugar is by removing water. Now, what about this phosphate business? You've met phosphate before in metabolism, and the unionized form, or phosphoric acid, is this compound, which has many features in common. The phosphate group has many features in common with the hydroxyl group, in that at pH 7, the hydrogens are often missing because the group is ionized. Now, phosphate is connected to the 5 prime, again, by removal of water. So if you remove water between these two and attach the phosphate, the proper formula, as shown on the bottom here, bottom left, is you have the CH2, and it's connected to the oxygen. So we've taken water out between the two OH here and OH here, and we've left with a phosphoester bond. Now, we've drawn it this way for convenience, but it's important to realize that just as a carboxyl is ionized at pH 7, at pH 7, these groups are also usually ionized. Now, as we'll see in DNA and in RNA, this phosphate group here is linked to the next nucleotide. But this one here is not. And this one is going to be ionized, and that's going to mean that there's going to be a lot of negative charge to account for due to the phosphate, due to this group. So a nucleotide then consists of a sugar connected by its 1 prime to a base, one of those 4, and at its 5 prime to a phosphate, which is usually either one singly or doubly ionized. But we're really interested in DNA and RNA. Just as we weren't really interested in amino acids, we were interested in proteins, we're really interested in DNA and RNA. How do you hook nucleotides up to make a macromolecule? Now, for that, you need page 2. Now, if you look 3 from the bottom, we've actually drawn a dinucleotide. Here, the base we've used is adenine, or A. We've just symbolized it by A for now. Here's the sugar. And there's, before we do anything else, you realize that there would be a CH2. Before I make the connection, there would be a phosphate, usually symbolized by a P with a circle here. And then if this is RNA, there'd be 2 hydroxyls here. But if it's DNA, there'd be a hydroxyl and an H. Now, nucleotides in DNA and in RNA are hooked together in the same manner. So if both DNA and RNA are hooked together in the same manner, this is the only group left that can hook to the next. If it were RNA, we could use this group. But we can't do that with DNA. So the only way you can link these two together is to remove water to make a link between the hydroxyl of one and the phosphate of the other. And the only question is, which way is it? Is it this hydroxyl to that phosphate, or this hydroxyl to that phosphate? And as shown in your picture, it's this phosphate to this hydroxyl. That's how the link is actually made. You remove water between them, and then you have a phosphodiester bond connecting the two of them. Like that. This is the same bond that's found in complex lipids. Now, this would be then, as drawn right in your picture, in the middle. Now, and I've drawn it here, charged. This is pretty messy, and I didn't even draw half the atoms. I cheated and left a whole bunch of them off. If you're going to draw things like this, you obviously need some kind of shorthand, or you're going to need reams and reams of paper and too much time. So what this page summarizes is the shorthand that is used, or one of them, in drawing nucleotides and nucleic acids. Now, one of the obvious shorthands here is to use the letter A instead of the base adenine, and respectively C instead of cytosine, T instead of thymine, etc. That's shown in row 2. For a base, the usual shorthand is just the first letter of its name. And the one that's shown here as an example is adenine. But what about the sugar? To make this picture simpler, the way we usually abbreviate a sugar is, instead of drawing out the whole thing like this, we just draw a line. And we indicate only the groups that are involved in making linkages, which are the 5' position, the 3' position, and the 1' position. Because the 1' is going to be linked to the base, the 3' is going to be linked to the previous phosphate, and the phosphate is going to be linked on the 5'. Now, in this kind of picture, it is arbitrary which side the hydroxyls are on. People are not worrying about stereochemistry here. Now, what does it look like when you add adenine to this thing? Well, where does the adenine go? Look at line 3. The adenine goes up here on the top to the 1', and you get this. Now, this is a sugar. This is a sugar plus a base, and it's called a nucleoside, as it says on your handout. When you add a phosphate, it becomes a nucleotide. Now, where does the phosphate go? Usually the phosphate is on the 5' position, as we wrote here. So that means I'm going to put the phosphate here. So now it's going to look like this. And the symbol for a phosphate is just a P with a circle. The state of ionization is not specified. It's assumed to be whatever is right at that pH. Now, you notice I have two versions of this on the handout. Sometimes people put an O in here. Sometimes they leave it out. It depends what point they're trying to make. Also, which side, left or right, the OH and the P are on doesn't matter either. Now, what have we got here? This is a sugar, a nucleoside, and a nucleotide. Or to be more exact, not only is this called a nucleotide, it's also called a nucleoside monophosphate. Now, you've actually already met something that looks sort of like this. And those are drawn, that's drawn on the bottom two rows of your handout. You've already heard a great deal about ADP and ATP. These are nucleoside di- and triphosphates. So what's that thing here? This is actually adenosine monophosphate, or AMP. ADP is just when you add another phosphate. So that would be ADP. What would ATP be? I just put another phosphate here. So these are the same old molecules we talked about before. ADP, ATP, AMP. If it's in DNA, it's deoxy-ATP or AMP or ADP. But otherwise, it's the same thing. Now, this may seem a little strange. You've already met ATP before. It had a well-known function. It's involved in energy metabolism. What's it doing in DNA and RNA? It's not at all unusual to find the same molecule used for more than one purpose. This is presumably a result of the way evolution works. Things that are already there are what you have as raw materials. If they can serve dual function, so much the better. So there has been selection for multiple use of a small number of molecules over and over and over. So ATP and its relatives have many different functions in the cell. And only one of them is in energy metabolism. So let's go back now to our picture. If we had two of these, how would they be linked up in this? We've already written the whole shebang, but how would you write this using the kind of shorthand we're talking about? So this would be sugar 1 with an A on it and sugar 2 with an A on it. And now how are they linked? This one has a phosphate on its 5 prime, so we draw that here. And its 3 prime is connected to the phosphate on the left. So it, in fact, would look like this. The one on the right has a 3 prime hydroxyl that's not connected to anybody. And the sugar on the left, or the nucleoside on the left, the nucleotide, has a phosphate on its 5 prime that's not connected to anybody. And this tells you that our bond goes from the 3 prime of the left sugar to the 5 prime of the right sugar. And as we've mentioned in the handout, putting O's here is optional. Now you can write an even shorter version of this, which is written underneath, or even shorter, just AA. Now, why would I write something just like AA? Because if I have a chain of nucleotides, this part is always the same. The part that varies is what bases are on top. So once I specify what bases are on top, I don't really need to write the rest of it. Now, to get a clearer version of this, look at page 3 on the upper right. What's drawn out there is a tetranucleotide with most of the atoms in there. But underneath is a shorter version using the symbolism we've just explained. That the very first base is G, the next one is C, the next one is T, and the next one is A. Now, the picture that's drawn out more carefully as a diagonal is more accurate. But this represents the same molecule, and which can even be shortened to G, C, T, A. Now, you may notice that there's some similarity to proteins. When you write out a protein chain, it has a backbone that is the same and repeats. You have carbon with R group. You have a carbon with an R group, C double bond ONH, carbon with R group, C double bond ONH, etc. You have a repeating structure, and the R groups stick out. Notice that this is similar. You have a repeating structure of sugar, phosphate, sugar, phosphate, sugar, phosphate, sugar, phosphate. Sometimes people write it this way. the bases stick out of the sugars. Now, the advantage of our shorthand is it makes it clear the way the other symbolism does not, that where the bonds are in terms of 3 and 5 prime. The one on the top doesn't show you that. Now, with proteins, there is a convention. The two ends of a protein chain are not the same. One end has a free amino, one end has a free carboxyl. By convention, you always write the amino end on the left. So when you write lys, his, asp, arg, everybody knows which one's at the amino end, which one's on the carboxyl end. For nucleotides, you have a similar setup. There's a convention that the group with the 5 prime unattached to another nucleotide is written on the left. And the nucleotide whose 3 prime is not connected to another nucleotide is written on the right. So just as proteins are always written amino to carboxyl, nucleotides are always written 5 prime to 3 prime. It's clear from the bottom picture, but not from the top, that the molecule is asymmetric. It has a head and a tail. That's not so obvious from the top. Now, you talk about the 5 prime end and the 3 prime end. In this particular picture, the 3 prime has a hydroxyl and the 5 prime has a phosphate, and that's very common. But it's not universal. This isn't called the 5 prime because it has a phosphate. It's called the 5 prime end because this 5 prime group is not linked to another nucleotide. And similarly, this is called the 3 prime end, not because it has a hydroxyl, but because the 3 prime position is not linked to the next guy. So we have here a little model. Suppose this is a nucleotide. This will be our DNA chain. So this is a nucleotide here. And this little white thing in the middle is the sugar. And the tubing represents the phosphate. And the colored stick represents the base. So you can see that there are two unique ends, which would be the 3 and the 5 prime end, actually. And they are linked then in a chain so that the sugar of one is linked to the phosphate of the next, which is linked to the sugar, which is linked to the phosphate of the next, etc. And so you have a sugar-phosphate backbone, and the bases stick out, just as with proteins, the R groups stick out. So this symbolism and all the other things we've drawn represent the primary structure of DNA. That is, which is specified, as long as I list the order of bases, I know what it is. When I write GCTA, I know that G is on the 5 prime end by convention and A is on the 3 prime end. Now, what good is this? Do we learn anything from looking at the primary structure of DNA? Do we have any inkling of how it does its jobs? Now, if you look at this, how does one make two? Nobody knows. You have to look at the 3D structure to figure out how one makes two. But remember, DNA has another job. DNA has the job of lining up amino acids, directly or indirectly, so they can be linked into protein. Do we have the information here to line up amino acids? Each DNA chain is very long and has a different sequence of bases. So, if it's long enough, the sequence of bases could tell us what amino acids to pick. Now, could I say, this tells me what the first amino acid is? This tells me the second. This tells me... No, that won't work. Because there are only 4 bases. So if it was one base, one amino acid, I could only specify 4 amino acids. But if you take these 3 at a time, which turns out to be the number, could be more, this combination of 3 bases specifies a particular amino acid. The next combination of 3 bases specifies another amino acid. There are plenty, in fact, excess combinations. And this is more or less the way it works. The DNA is read out three bases at a time to specify the order of amino acids. How it does that, we won't get to for a couple of days. But that's the basic idea. The point is, by looking at the structure, you can conceive how you have the information here to do job one, but not job two. Now, does the primary structure of DNA help us in any other way? It turns out that knowing the primary structure of DNA has been extraordinarily useful in things that have nothing to do with biology. It's had enormous impact in forensics, as you probably know. The DNA of every individual is unique, except for their identical twin, which may even that may be a little bit different. When a person commits a crime, they often leave some of their bodily fluids and DNA behind, or they sometimes take some of the DNA from the victim. And therefore, it is possible by matching to often establish who the perpetrator was. Now, this means that DNA tests are used both to catch the guilty and to clear the innocent. And if you've been reading the newspaper, there are regular reports of DNA use for both of these things. And so I haven't bothered to give you any articles on this because it's so well known. But I have given you two articles which are about uses of the primary structure of DNA. You notice that neither of these comes from the science section of the Times. One comes from the business section from yesterday, and one is a few months ago from the front page. The point being that the news about DNA is all over the place. The technology article is about the use of sequencing of getting the entire order of A's, G's, C's, and T's of individuals. There are companies that do this. Since this is from the business section, it explains both the business, will the companies survive and make money, and it explains why you might want to do this. And I'll leave the article for you to read. The other side was on the front page, I think because of its human interest. DNA can also be used to establish what species a sample of, say, fish comes from. What they do here is basically to examine the sequence of bases in a particular gene, and they take the corresponding gene from all different kinds of fish. And this, the way they do it, they produce a pattern that looks like a barcode, and that's why it's called barcoding. So they're comparing, you can establish what fish this is by taking a little sample, locating the appropriate gene, how you do that we'll discuss later, and getting the sequence of bases in a piece of that gene. And what this article is about is that a couple of high school students who liked sushi went and bought a lot of sushi, took samples, sent them off to a testing lab, and found out what fish they really came from, as opposed to what fish it said on the menu. And the reason this is in the paper is they didn't always match. And needless to say, the fish it really was often a much cheaper fish than the fish it was supposed to be. Now, whether this is of any great significance, except for connoisseurs of sushi, I don't know. But it's a very interesting example of the use of this technology. Another use of this technology has been to establish whale meat that is sold commercially. Does it come from the whales it's supposed to come from, or does it come from species of whales that are supposed to be protected? A similar test has been done. So you can read the article and see if it interests you. You can look it up, more details on the web. Okay, so knowing the primary, how DNA works, how its primary sequence is set up, has in fact given us some useful information and some useful tools. But it hasn't explained to us how one DNA molecule makes two. So that was figured out by Watson and Crick looking at the 3D structure. Just as you can't figure out what a protein does until you figure out its 3D structure, you can't really figure out how DNA works until you get its 3D structure. Now, Watson and Crick did not do any wet experiments. What they did was to realize that the structure of DNA was a very important business, and they assembled all the information that had been found by others and put it all together, and they used it to build models. And the first model they built was so wrong that their colleagues laughed them to scorn, but their second model was right on. So what information did they have? Well, they knew that regular 3D DNA is a long, thin, rigid rod. Now, this is not a rigid rod. This is floppy. And so they knew from other data that there were several chains like that, two or more, stuck together by weak bonds in each molecule. They knew when they were connected by weak bonds because if you just heated the DNA up, it sort of fell apart and got floppy. You didn't have to break any covalent bonds. You only had to break weak bonds. So it had lots of weak bonds. Now, they had a lot of X-ray data, which implied that in its crystalline form, the molecule had regular repeats. But they weren't sure exactly what the structure was from the pattern. They guessed it was a helix, but they weren't sure. Now, there was this question of how many chains, so I'll just write down that they knew about regular repeats. But as one of your textbooks says, X-ray crystallography is difficult to do and even harder to explain. So I'm not going to even try. Now, about these chains per molecule, they had to make a guess. Were there two? Were there three? Were there four? And Crick is supposed to have said, biological things come in pairs. Now, there are some molecules that have three chains, but he happened to be right about this one. It has two. It's not clear what he was thinking of at the time. Maybe he was thinking of Noah's Ark, you know, pairs. But he was a very anti-religious man. So whether that was his image, I don't know. But he said biological things come in pairs, and he happened to be right. Now, using all the information that was available, my DNA molecule is getting old. It requires a little surgery, I think. So before I do this, I just want to be sure I put it together right, which I didn't. Just a second. Okay. So, Watson and Crick figured that there must be two chains in the molecule. And so did others. Pauling was working on the same problem. Pauling's the one who figured out that proteins have alpha helices. And they, both groups were working on the 3D structure. And they really weren't sure which way it went. Whether it went this way or whether it went this way. Now, Pauling published a model that went this way. Now, when Pauling published a model, Watson and Crick said, oh no, we've been scooped. They figured it out. Then they looked at the paper. They said, oh, he got it wrong. And they went to the bar and they got drunk and they celebrated. Now, why were they sure he was wrong? What's wrong with this? Phosphates. Remember those phosphates? Phosphates are negatively charged. Now, why did he come up with this model? We know that this is the part that has the information. So from the point of view of reading the thing, this seems like a sensible thing to do. You can get the information from it. If you do it this way, the information is buried. So that doesn't seem as reasonable. But the trouble with this is that the bases have a partially hydrophobic character, and they're sticking into the water. The two negatively charged chains are away from the water in with each other. So this is no good. So it must be something like this. Now, you remember that the bases come in two sizes. But how are the bases related to each other? At the time of the transformation experiment, Chargaff, who was at Columbia University but at the medical school, decided to investigate further the structure of DNA. And his results are on the back page on the bottom. He very carefully, by meticulous biochemical experiments, isolated DNA from different sources, hydrolyzed it into its components, and measured the proportions of A, T, G, and C. And Watson and Crick knew about this. These are Chargaff's results. Now, this is what illustrates that the proportion of A, say, is different in DNA from different sources. 30% approximately in humans, 15% in the tuberculosis bacillin. But there are some regularities here which Chargaff noticed. Does any one column equal any other column? Approximately. A equals T and G equals C within experimental error. So Chargaff realized that the amount of A was always equal to the amount of T, and the G was always equal to the amount of C. And if you add it up, the A plus G, remember, that's the purines, the big guys, equals the amount of T plus C, which is the pyrimidines, the small guys. So the number of big bases equals the number of small bases. So that made sense, because if you made a structure like this, you'd always put a purine opposite a pyrimidine in order to have a decent match. But as I'm sure you all know, in addition, you always put A opposite T and G opposite C, so that the structure you end up with looks like this. There is a constant distance across, because it's always one purine, one pyrimidine. A always goes with T in either orientation, and G always goes with C, and as you know, it's the famous double helix. It's coiled like that. Now, it's obvious to us that A goes with T and G goes with C, but it wasn't obvious to them, and it took them a long time to figure it out. And one of the reasons for that is that neither Watson nor Crick really knew any chemistry at all. And so when they wanted the structure of DNA, of the bases, they looked it up in a book. And we have here, on the top of your handout, we have T and A as they are correctly. We know that these are the structures of T and A in solution. This is what you'll find today if you look in a book. And when you line them up like that, it becomes pretty obvious that you can form a hydrogen bond here and a hydrogen bond here. Now, why can't you make one here? This H is not attached to a nitrogen or an oxygen. It's not attached to an electronegative atom. It's not delta positive. And anyway, this distance is too long anyway. So this hydrogen is not capable of making a hydrogen bond. But if you line them up like this, it becomes clear that you can make two hydrogen bonds between A and D and three hydrogen bonds between G and C. And when you get home, you can try it yourself, or you can also check yourself on page 10.3 where we've shown the matches. But for now, we're just going to say you can do it. A pairs nicely with T, G pairs nicely with C. But in those days, if you looked up T in a book, the structure you would have seen is not what we call the keto structure, which has double bond O's here, but the enol structure, which has one double bond O and one OH. Now, if you look it up like this and you try and pair it to A, what happens? These are both delta negative. There's no hydrogen, and these are both delta positive. So this form of T, the enol form, does not hydrogen bond with A. So Watson kept making models and trying to make this fit, and it wouldn't fit. And the story is that one of his colleagues, who was a chemist, walked in one day when he was messing with his models, looked over his shoulder and said, "Everybody knows," quote unquote, "that that's the wrong form of T in solution. The books are out of date. T looks like that." And Watson said, "Oh." And Watson had a new model made where the T and the G were in the keto form, and lo and behold, G hydrogen bonded neatly to C, A to T, and he got the double helix. So they came up with this model, and as soon as they did it, they went to the bar, they got roaring drunk, and they claimed they had discovered the secret of life. They asked Crick's wife about this, and she said, "I didn't get excited. He always came home and said things like that." But this time they were right. And when they actually published their paper, this is what it said. This is too rich to paraphrase. "This structure has novel features which are of considerable biological interest." They also say, "The genetic implications of this structure have not escaped our notice." Now, Crick was English, but Watson has no excuse. for this behavior. So what were the biologically important properties? What were the genetic implications that have not escaped their notice? How does this do job two? What's it supposed to do? One's supposed to make two, right? Well, what's holding this together in real life? Is there hydrogen bonds here, right? Hydrogen bonds are pretty weak, so we bake a few hydrogen bonds here. And we get two halves. But suppose that half got lost and we only have this one. Well, following this rules that we have, we know that T goes always with A, G goes always with C, etc. There is information here sufficient if we have a supply of raw materials to put in the missing half. Because each half is complementary to the other, as long as I have one half, I know what the other half ought to be. So I ought to be able to fill this in. And what about this one? Same thing. I should be able now, using this half as a template, to make a complete double, and this half as a template to make a complete double. That is, DNA has a self-complementary structure which explains very neatly how one could be used to make two. And that, in fact, is the next question that we want to consider next time. We're going to do a few details about the non-genetical implications of this structure. And then we're going to get to the question, is this really how it happens in a cell? Does it really come apart, and does each act as a template to line up raw materials and make the missing half? So the next lecture is not Thursday, but Friday in this room at the usual time. Unfortunately, I cannot repeat it on Monday, for which I apologize. If there are people who need us to schedule some extra time, you should let me know. See you on Friday.